Ryan Smithy, joined in the studio with Chip Horton.
Hello, hello, hello.
Certainly thankful that you all have been able to join us this morning for a wonderful chapter, at the same time a challenging chapter. we have a lot to get through and a very deep chapter in terms of the content. And I tell you, last night, I think any time we approach the study of God's Word, we ought to be humbled, but as I was looking through some of this, I couldn't help but think about that great charge before us this morning, to look at Matthew chapter 27, and to do so in any way that might give it a slight bit of justice that it deserves in the hour that we have. We have a challenge before us, but I want to dive right in to that study and begin looking in Matthew chapter 27. And so I hope that if you're where you can sit down with us, that you will open your Bibles and study right there along with us. And so, Chip, how about we just go ahead right off the bat with verse 1 and 2.
Okay, Matthew 27, verse 1, beginning when the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor.
Of course, a lot hits my mind right off. We talked yesterday. We didn't get to go into detail. I certainly hope maybe you can go and look at some of those injustices of chapter 26. But it continues right here in chapter 27 the next day. Mm-hmm. That ultimately what I'm reminded of, they had already decided the outcome. They had decided the fate. Now they, having met during the night, now that morning is coming on, they have to figure out a way to get this carried out. They no longer have the power of death because they are under Roman rule and control. And so they'll be trying to convince Pilate now to put Jesus to death, and know that they're going to have to do some more gymnastics to get that done, because their big charge concerned the temple. You know, the two witnesses that they finally got to agree that Jesus would tear down the temple and build it again in 3 days, and wanted to charge him with blasphemy. Well, that might have convinced them to stone him under their law, but it wouldn't convince Pilate to crucify him under Roman law.
Do you think he'd even recognize the blasphemy of Christ, right, of God? I mean, I don't think he'd even recognize that.
I think there's likely some scheming in their mind that they know we've got to present something here against this man. In fact, Luke 23. Verse 1 and 2. Of course, all the accounts are going to give us more information, but I'm reminded there that the charges that they're going to bring forth are perverting the nation, forbidding the Jews to give tribute to Rome, and claiming to be a king. Mm. And just last night in our Bible Bowl section, we talked about what did Jesus really teach? Well, he taught given to Caesar what was Caesar's,
right,
and unto God what was God's. And so these were charges that they were building up for a specific purpose, and that's to get them to get the Roman government to allow them to crucify Jesus. And so they take him forth unto Pilate. Again, it's interesting as you kind of look through these various accounts, and you look at their hypocrisy. They're so interested in the time frame, so interested in putting him to death, that they're going to take him to Pilate. But again, John particularly, John 18, is going to give us more details concerning the fact that they wouldn't even enter into the judgment hall of Pilate lest they defile themselves for the upcoming feast day. And so as they're taking him away, they're binding him. Some suggest probably just binding him more securely for transport, taking him unto Pilate. Well, he's going to go into the judgment hall, but they're going to stand without. And Pilate's having to go kind of back and forth, hear the charges, and then go investigate Jesus by himself. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to see that carried out here in this chapter. Well, let's continue and see what happens there in about verse 3 through 10.
All right, beginning verse 3. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself, and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned in that I betrayed the innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? See thou to that. And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went out and hanged himself. And the chief priest took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful for to put them into the treasury, because it is the price of blood. And they took counsel and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Wherefore that field was called the field of blood unto this day. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremy the prophet, saying, and they took 30 pieces of silver, the price of him that was valued, whom they of the children of Israel did value, and gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord appointed me.
You know, as we begin to look at Judas again, of course, Matthew was not necessarily a chronological writer.
Right.
And this event is one that I had not ever paid quite as much attention to, but suggested that Matthew is actually placing this probably before the chronological events of Matthew 27 are taking place. In other words, Judas is seeing these events transpire. It may be that this event actually happens later, closer to the time of the crucifixion, that he's being led away. There's a few triggers there that some look at. The idea that he's going back to the chief priest in verse 6, and he's casting them down, the money, that is, in verse 5. Mm-hmm. Well, the chief priest and the elders, everybody, were at Pilate's hall in chronological order here. And so this may have been even after they have returned to their service there in the temple. So probably a later time, after he's seen what all is happening to Jesus, after he understands that, I've sentenced this man to death. Again, we talked a little bit yesterday that perhaps Judas, while he was wrong in his actions, perhaps didn't fully understand the consequence or the end of what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Some have suggested he thought he was just pushing Jesus into the rightful role. Some thought he thought by betraying Jesus, he'd have to rise up and defend himself as the king or reveal his hand. And now Judas is beginning to understand they're going to put this man to death.
Mm-hmm.
And there is regret here. As you look in verse 3, it says he repented himself. Literally, the idea there is regret.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in his case, this regret was certainly great, so great that some have made that interesting fact, that which was so precious to him became so worthless to him.
Hmm.
That 30 pieces of silver that was so valuable that he would betray Jesus is now nothing to him, so that he comes and he is trying to return this money. It's interesting here as we look at Judas. There are different words used throughout the New Testament. This particular word simply means regret when it talks about Judas repenting. It does not necessarily show the attitude of repentance, though, that true idea of changing, of turning.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had this regret, he had this remorse over what he had done, but wasn't willing to ultimately try to make amends over those things. And so instead of turning to God, we're going to see here Judas actually taking his life.
Mm-hmm.
When you look there in verse 4, how does he speak of Jesus, that he had sinned in betraying innocent blood.
There's a testimony right there, isn't it?
That certainly is. That you look, that Judas was one who has spent time, like the other apostles, he spent time with Jesus, and now is coming and say, I know who this man is. And he didn't see Jesus as guilty. I mean, here's one that benefited from this financially, and yet now he's recognizing and confessing, this man is innocent. And so they had used Judas to accomplish their evil plan, and they show a very callousness here that now they have no use for him. They speak harshly to him. What is this to us? And Judas is going to cast that money down. And verse 5, it says, he went and hanged himself. And that in fulfillment of Zechariah 11, verse 12 and 13, if you want to make some references there concerning some of these prophecies and and their fulfillment. And again, that note, how many people have been led away by the love of money and the temptations of this life only to discover the worthlessness of what they had gained?
That's it.
And again, if Judas' life stands in a testimony to anything, I think that certainly has to rise to our minds. And new few notes here. I think you have to link some various ideas. Acts chapter 1 is going to give us some details concerning what happened to Judas. Again, Luke is going to give us some details, but it seems that Judas goes out and he hangs himself. Acts is going to record that in Acts 1 and verse 18 that he fell forth and his bowels burst out. It's made reference here to this field that he purchased. I think when you combine all of these things, what you see happening is Judas is going forth into a place of desolation, and he is hanging himself. And whether the tree limb would eventually break, whether you know, the rope would snap in that process, that he falls headlong into this valley. And this money that he has cast back, the hypocrisy of these Jews that had, again, how do you wrap your mind around that? That they paid that blood money that they don't want anything to do with now. They recognized the sinfulness of dealing with that now. But I'm continually amazed by that fact that you're the one that paid it.
That's right.
And it seems that they go and buy a worthless field, basically. Some have suggested it was a field from which they had gathered clay and now was worthless for nothing except a burial plot for the poor. And so all of those overlap to where Judas has hung himself in this area. That's the field they have purchased with that money that he threw back. And so in that sense, Judas purchased the field and died in that area. And so what a tragic end to the potential that could have been when we think about Judas. That here was one that was with Jesus, that saw all the miracles that he did, but was caught up in the allurement of this world and and the love of money.
I thought of Bernie Madoff. You remember him?
Oh, yeah.
The one that tore people's 401ks to pieces, destroyed their livelihoods, and, you know, held on as long as he could. And, you know, just to see him walking the streets as people pushed on him and shoved him and spoke down to him, you know, he's a man that certainly fell from a big, tall glass tower for sure. But he loved that money.
And then how unable one in such a position is to deal with the conflict or the remorse that comes from that, and certainly we see that in Judas. I will make a note there in verse 9 and 10, won't get into the details there, but the quotation that's admitted there is attributed to Jeremiah. Some have again noted that actually is found in Zechariah 11 and verse 12. Some have made reference that Zechariah was possibly a reference there to the prophets as a whole, that Zechariah, in the way in which they would line up the prophets, Jeremiah would come first, and so they would use Jeremiah in reference to all of the prophets there. That's certainly a possibility. Another is the closeness of Jeremiah and Zechariah in the abbreviated form, that perhaps there is a scribal error there. There's a few different possibilities there. We won't necessarily go into all of those, but Zechariah 11 and verse 12 could be a reference there that we could make to the prophets. And so another you might reference there, Jeremiah 32. Verse 6 through 8, and look into those a little more as well. But now Matthew's going to take us back, and I think, again, the suggestion, probably Judas has been moved to that point just as Jesus is being led away, not to break the flow later. But now we go back, and we are again in Pilate's hall with Jesus before Pilate in verse 11 through 23.
All right. Beginning at verse 11, and Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, Art thou the king of the Jews? And Jesus said unto him, Thou sayest. And when he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then said Pilate unto him, Hearest thou not how many things they witness against thee? And he answered him to never a word, insomuch that the governor marveled greatly. Now at that feast the governor was wont to release unto the people a prisoner whom they would. And they had then a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore when they gathered together, Pilate said unto them, Whom will ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ? For he knew that for envy they had delivered him. When he was set down on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, Have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. But the governor answered and said unto them, Whether of the twain will ye that I release unto you? They said, Barabbas. Pilate saith unto them, What shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ? They all say unto him, Let him be crucified. And the governor said, Why? What evil hath he done? But they cried out the more, saying, Let him be crucified.
All right. Again, we look and we get to see Jesus here before Pilate. We're not given all of the details here. As far as a few references, let me give those to you that you can go and find some more of these details. But Mark 15, verse 2 through 5. Luke 23, verse 1 through 5, John 18, verse 29 through 38 could give us more information on these accounts. And Matthew doesn't really record for us this back and forth that Pilate must have gone through that day, that he has to go outside and say, Why did you bring him to me? What's his charge? And then go back inside and say, Who are you? What is this that they're saying against you? They've come and they're charging Jesus as being worthy of death, and they're going to have to convince Pilate of that now, or at least attempt to get Pilate to say this. And so I think Matthew jumps right for us here in verse 11, and the governor is asking, Art thou the king of the Jews? Likely this is already, you know, he's already gone forth and heard the charge from the Jews, and now he's coming back to ask Jesus about the charge that they have placed before him. It's interesting Jesus' response that he's going to want to know, well, who has said this? Is it you or is it they? You know, if Pilate's asking, Are you king of the Jews? Well, no, I'm not an earthly king.
Mm-hmm.
If the Jews are saying, Are you king of the Jews? Well, yes, I am your king in a spiritual sense. I think those things are important.
And again, that's the point of Matthew, right?
Right.
Pointing out his kingship.
And so are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus says, Thou sayest. Here, this is an affirmative answer that Jesus is giving. It has been said. You have rightly said. And so still, he's going to be accused, verse 12 and following there. And Pilate, I can only imagine, is amazed. How many times, you imagine, as one who has had to rule over cases, has he had people stand before him that have begged and pleaded for their life?
Mm-hmm.
have, even when mountains of evidence are placed before them, and they're saying, no, no, that's not me. I didn't do it. Mm-hmm. And here's Jesus, who Pilate likely can see through. Well, in fact, we know from other places he can see through the charges, that he knows they've delivered Jesus because of envy.
Right, verse 18.
And here Jesus says nothing.
Hmm. Which makes them even more mad, doesn't it? I can just see it.
I mean, this is just going to amaze him. And like you said, probably puzzle and possibly anger him. How do I help you if you're not seemingly wanting to help yourself?
Mm.
And, you know, some comment throughout that, you know, one of the reasons Jesus is silent is he has no obligation to condemn himself or even ultimately to defend himself. The charge, the burden of proof, is on his accusers.
That's right.
And so he remains silent. And Pilate, in various places we learn there, I think his knowledge that Jesus is innocent grows through this time. But yet he has this angry mob. He has this these people before him that are demanding his death, and Pilate does everything he can, seemingly here, to try to defuse the situation, even at times try to cast the responsibility off of himself. Others are going to record for us how he would send him unto Herod, hoping, well, maybe you ought to be in Herod's jurisdiction. Let him go and hear you. Of course, made Herod happy. He had always wanted to see Jesus. But then Herod's going to send him back to Pilate. Again, you have to go to Luke 23 to read that account before Herod. You know, now I'm still searching. What do I do with this man? And so we come down into Matthew's account. He tells us in verse 15 of this plan, well, it's custom for us to release someone to you. This was probably the idea that, you know, the Jews were upset being under Roman rule, and so they had made a custom to kind of mollify the people. At this time of year, they would release someone from their custody back to the Jews. And so he sets forth this Barabbas, who is identified in verse 16 and 17 as one who was notable. He was a distinguished, and that's that can be used for good, but in Barabbas's case, it's not.
Like Charles Manson.
He's
everybody knows him.
Yeah, I bet say he's notable for the wickedness that he had done. And so he's going to set Barabbas. Well, do you want me to release Jesus or Barabbas? And I think surely in his mind, Pilate's saying, they'll never release Barabbas. Surely they'll choose Jesus. But yet here the crowd has been stirred up. He doesn't count on the hatred that has developed against Jesus, and they begin calling out, release unto us Barabbas. Mm. And so that plan has failed. Then again, in verse 19 of Matthew there, even his wife is going to send him a message. And again, you know.
And how does she refer to him?
When you look here again, she's begging with him, basically, have nothing to do with this just man.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what she knew about Jesus, I don't fully know. But I think she was even able to understand the charges that had been trumped up against him, and knowing where her husband was that day, and the fear of not wanting him to have anything to do with that man.
Mm.
Even she is pleading in that situation for his release. But there and again in verse 20, the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude. I don't exactly know how, again, all that took place, whether they had positioned themselves to the crowd, whether they had, spoken to the people of how they had found Jesus guilty of blasphemy, and so they had stirred up the people against Jesus. And again, it always goes back to me to such an amazement what a short period of time has passed from Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem, where the people were calling out Hosanna and singing praises unto God.
Mm-hmm.
And standing here on this occasion and calling for the release of Barabbas and the crucifixion of Jesus. But that's exactly what we see transpiring before us.
You know, as I read through those two verses there, just before we transitioned here, I thought about 1 Samuel 8, where even though, you know, Samuel gave them the future, mm-hmm. you know, what a king would do,
mm-hmm.
they continued. You know, as the people continued to scream here, they continued to scream, give us a king, give us a king, give us a king. They weren't going to have it any other way. And so certainly they got what, you know, what was coming to them, and certainly what we see here as well.
And, you know, that crowd mentality sometimes I think is at fault there, that just the lack of reasoning. And we think we want a certain thing, and we're not going to be persuaded away from that. And that's what that crowd has built up into, until finally Pilate has to ask the question, and a soul-searching question even today in verse 22 and 23, what which is called the Christ?
Sermon.
Mm-hmm. And probably we've all delivered, excuse me, something similar or heard something similar. What do I do with Jesus? Pilate had Jesus on his hands in the situation there. You've delivered him unto me. What do I do with him? He recognizes here the justness of Jesus, the innocence of Jesus, but he has this mob before him that's calling out for his death and saying, crucify him. In many ways, the people were asked, what do you do with him? And that was their answer, crucify him.
Mm-hmm.
And each of us today, as we are faced with the gospel, are faced with the same question, what do I do with Jesus? Do I reject him? Do I mock him? Do I scorn him? Do I listen to him? Do I humble myself to him?
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people try to take that option of, well, I listen to him as a good teacher, but nothing more. But if we're honest with ourselves and with the scriptures, then we're going to recognize him even as his disciples did, that he is Jesus the Christ with the words of eternal life. So what will you do with Jesus? Certainly a verse to highlight there within the pages of the Bible. But we must press forward. Let's go ahead and look now as Jesus is condemned and being led forth to Golgotha in verse 24 through 33.
Verse 24, when Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See you to it. Then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Then released he Barabbas unto them. And when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the common hall and gathered unto him the whole band of soldiers. And they stripped him and put on a scarlet robe. And when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head, and a reed in his right hand. And they bowed the knee before him, and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews! And they spit upon him, and took the reed, and smote him on the head. And after that they had mocked him, they took the robe off from him, and put his own raiment on him, and led him away to crucify him. And as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross. And when they were come unto a place called Golgotha, that is to say, a place of the skull, they gave him vinegar to drink, mingled with gall. And when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink.
We'll pause right in there. It's not necessarily a great break there, but there's certainly a lot there already.
Boy.
to try to discuss and get a grasp of what's going on here. But you have Pilate, who recognizes, I can't do anything with this crowd. Everything he has attempted, and there does, you know, Pilate is one of those interesting characters. I think we can have too much sympathy for him, but at the same time, understand the difficult situation that he's in.
Mm-hmm.
Pilate is not innocent. He tries to wash his hands. Even this would likely anger the crowds because Pilate, again, is giving testimony. This man's innocent.
That's right.
I don't want his blood on my hands. But the crowd is going to persuade him. Other places, other accounts are going to remind us that they use this I forget what the right word I'm looking for there is, but they're going to say, you know, if you let Jesus go, you're no friend of Caesar's. And so they're goading Pilate into basically a situation Pilate feels he has no other option.
Mm-hmm.
But as much as he wants to wash his hands, he is guilty of basically signing the death warrant for an innocent man and one whom he is going to prove to say so.
Isn't it interesting, Ryan, how that here the same individuals that goaded Jesus, that pushed Jesus into corners so many times, and Jesus just walked away and left them with their mouths gaping open.
Mm-hmm.
Pilate's unable to do that.
Yeah. He has no
unable
answer.
To do that.
He has no answer. He didn't have the wisdom there. He didn't have the answers to say. Though he even recognizes him as innocent, nevertheless, he has him led away.
Mm-hmm.
And then verse 25, that answer of the people, you know, as Pilate tries to wash his blood or hands of this blood, of this situation, and the Jewish people would cry out, let his blood be on us.
That's crazy.
Probably never more a regretted statement in many ways. The Jews to this day, they get when such a charge is laid before them. But we look and we see what a rough history, you know, even immediately there, how their whole Jewish economy is going to crumble, as it were, within a period of less than 40 years. In AD 70, the city destroyed, thousands of Jewish people killed, and then what remnant remained, which is interesting, even though the genealogies and everything are destroyed, but what remnant of those Jewish people remain have had a rough time through history.
Mm-hmm.
But they accepted this. They said, his blood will be on us. And certainly there were those, Acts chapter 2, who finally would recognize their folly, recognize what they did, repented of their sins and were immersed in Christ, immersed in water for the remission of their sins. That guilt was washed away. Well, that guilt in the sense of that sin was washed away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have a hard enough time forgiving ourselves for certain sins of our lives. I can only imagine what some of them likely felt through their lives. But they would call out for that blood to be on their hands. They would release Barabbas, but Jesus would be delivered to be crucified. And we see how this begins as Pilate is going to have Jesus scourged. And some have suggested even yet Pilate is trying to justify or calm the people. Maybe if I take him and I beat him and we scourge him, they will see him, take pity on him, and want him released. But even then, they still want him to be crucified. I can't imagine the situation here that begins to develop in verse 27. But here the soldiers of the governor are going to take him into the common hall, gather the whole band of soldiers. One reference here says a band of Roman soldiers said to have numbered in the hundreds, depending on the size of the legion. Possibly we're talking as many as 600. I mean, this isn't four or five men that have gathered around Jesus and just laughed at him. This is possibly hundreds of Roman soldiers mm-hmm. who, to some degree, have been desensitized to the sufferings that they probably had to see quite often.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are doing this mocking. They're the ones that are doing this cruel treatment here, the scourging in and of itself. Would have been rough, and that's not even a good term there. Chip, I know you've done some looking at that scourging. Some idea you can give us there?
It's a horrible thing. It's a band of cords that's made, and there's actually hooks. Some have showed to be three-pronged hooks. Some have showed hooks as vicious as even a fishing lure. And there's pieces of bone and metal and all these things woven within the cords. And the point is to rip the skin off of the body. And the things that I've read in the past show that his lungs would be exposed. The muscle, the sinew that was ripped would be hanging. You could see the inner organs, even those things in the back of, the kidneys. Those things could have very well been visible. And so that goes to the point of, what comes in the future of putting the robe on him, taking the robe off of him, how quickly the blood begins to clot. And as you take it off, you just reopen that wound, like ripping a big scab open again. And just the horror, we could really go into some deep detail, but it was a horrible scene indeed.
And so remember that when you're standing here, he has been scourged, which scourging in and of itself would take the life of some men.
Yeah, most of them die.
And so, all this flesh ripped from you, you're bleeding, you're already physically drained from a long night of these trials and these things that have happened. Now you've gone through that beating. Now these soldiers have gathered around you. They're mocking you. There's this emotional drain here as well. Putting this robe on and off, as you have mentioned, it likely would have disturbed the wounds, the mocking of the crown of thorns. You claim to be a king, and so they're putting this crown with these sharp swords on his thorns on his head, and then beating that to where it would drive into his skull. There's blood flowing all over his body. I mean, how sanitized society. We don't see a lot of that. We don't even see the meat markets. I mean, we have nicely packaged beef that you just pick up in a wrapper. Yeah. I mean, we're not used to any images of that sort. And all of that mocking, "Hail, King of the Jews." And so again, this physical, this emotional drain, spitting on him, beating him with that reed, on the head with his thorns, and now having mocked him, they take away all of those things, and now will lead him out to the place of his own death and force him there to bear his cross. Others will remind us that he does have some help along the way. They force one, Simon of Cyrene, to help bear that cross outside to Calvary. It's we know it there by various names, the place of the skull, likely because of the appearance of that area. And here they have brought him forth to be crucified. And again, Matthew doesn't deal a lot with that. We see him leading out there, and then he really kind of, in a sense, skips over that. But, they've led him down this place, down this road of sorrow, or the sorrowful way, and they would bring that cross that has come out, and they would bind him to it, most likely, and then drive the nails through his hands and through his feet, and set that cross up to where now the weight of his body is being borne by his feet and by his hands, And you're already physically sore and in pain. Likely every movement there is causing pain, and the weight of your body as it hangs there on the cross more and more is increasing that pressure on the lungs, to where it makes it harder and harder to be able to breathe. And the Romans had perfected, in if I can use that word, but perfected this as a death of torture.
Yeah, they didn't invent it. They made it worse, though.
You're right. Certainly made this to where it there was no pleasantness to this.
Mm.
And here he has been hung on the cross. And let's continue in the events of this afternoon or this day in verse 34 through 38.
Verse 34, they gave him vinegar to drink and mingled it with gall, and when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink. And they crucified him and parted his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, they parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots. And sitting down, they watched him there, and set up over his head his accusation, written, This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. When then were there two thieves crucified.
Death that he was led to, and again, very little information concerning the actual crucifixion here was given, but other accounts will fill in some information there for us, here he's already gone through the scourging. He's had to carry his cross, which would be a great weight. He's now hanging upon that cross by the nails in his hands and his feet. And now your wounds are not only causing a lack of blood, but they're a source of pain, and that rough wood would be rubbing on the back that's already been torn up. Even little movements will send pain through your body. Exposure is going to be a cause of death for many, because all of these wounds that are exposed to the open air, the blood that you not only would be losing, but blood would be forced into the head and the stomach, both causing pain. This increasing agony, the thirst, the difficulty breathing, eventually would bring about one's death. But, again, designed in such a way where death would not be immediate. Some might even last 4 days.
Mm.
And so a painful way of death. And so they've brought him here and they've crucified him. Now they are parting his garments. They're dividing them up among the soldiers. But they will not take that outer garment there
Seamless is the garment.
One of the garments that was seamless. They cast lots for. Again, all of this fulfilled prophecy. And I'm going to have to pardon me. I had that prophecy highlighted, and it's not.
Psalm 22:18? Is that the one? Prophecies of dividing the clothes.
Okay.
I just kind of scribbled that there, but
and so
hope that's it.
there we are. The soldiers fulfilled the prophecy in Psalm 22:18 again there for your reference, and this accusation, Jesus, King of the Jews, true, but set up there as a mock of his claim, and so again, you have the humiliation along with this painful death, and to be hung there with these robbers, one who noted was not just a thief, but probably stronger than that. This is one that by violence has taken that which is not his,
mm-hmm.
And so he hangs there with these two, and. Again, I wish we could spend more time with that idea of the crucifixion and the pain that he suffered. Matthew just gives us a tiny glimpse into that truly horrible day. And now it is increased in verse 39 through 44 because of the verbal insults now, the verbal staves, if you will, that are thrown at him. Let's go ahead with verse 39 through 44.
All right, 39. And they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads and saying, "Thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself. If thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise, also the chief priest, mocking him with the scribes and elders, said, "He saved others, himself he cannot save. And if he be the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God, let him deliver him now, if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. The thieves also, which were crucified with him, cast the same in his teeth."
Okay, so again, just to give us an idea here that you know, it wasn't just the death. Here's a crowd, and everybody that's passing for is hurling these insults and wagging their head. It's, again, an insulting gesture, mocking him, challenging him. "Oh, if you're who you claim to be, why don't you come down from the cross? And you saved others. Why can you not save yourself?" And, you know, all these things that they would, thinking they have triumphed. This is what they wanted, to silence Jesus, to remove him, and will think now that they have triumphed over him. But they will learn the true story later. In fact, we'll get to deal with that tomorrow. But even those who were hung with him are going to be hurling these insults at him again. Luke 23 will mention that one of these robbers seems to have repented. He will later change his accusations and even defend Jesus, that they were there justly. We deserve what we're getting, but that man does not. And so, again, keep in mind this not only physical abuse, but the emotional abuse that he's going through there. And then his final hours, verse 45 through 49.
"Now from the sixth hour there was darkness all over the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Some of them that stood there, when they heard that, said, This man calleth for Elias. And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. The rest said, Let be. Let us see whether Elias will come and save him."
Okay. There we see from the sixth hour to the ninth hour, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, about noon to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that is, he hangs on the cross for about 6 hours before he dies. But in those last 3 hours, there is this darkness that spreads. It comes suddenly on at noon. There is no accounting for this naturally. It is not the time in which you could have had a solar eclipse. And even at that, it would not, a solar eclipse would not last this long.
Mm-hmm.
So here is a miraculous event in which at least part of the earth is shaded here, and the sun will not shine during this time upon that part of the earth. And a witness. My mind, I couldn't help but go to Psalm 19 and the idea of there is no language in which it is not heard, as it speaks about the creation testifying to there is a God. And I thought of that in reference to this, just how there's no language in which you can miss the fact that there was indeed something special about Jesus.
Amen.
As he is dying here on the cross, and this darkness spreads upon the face of the earth, and then this pronouncement of Jesus, one of his seven sayings: my God, why have you forsaken me?" And various things can be said about that. Various things have been answered as to what exactly was meant. I am one who leans to the idea that here Jesus in this great agony. He has come to do the Father's will. He has prayed, if there is any other way, let this cup pass from me, but your will be done. And I look back at his life and how he was with God and God was with him and protecting him. But this is the one situation in which God has to stay his hand. And that here, as I offer my life, I know my Father cannot save me. This is the answer to his prayer in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any other way, but there is no other way.
Right.
And so here God is having to restrain himself. You know, Isaiah tells us, Isaiah 53, of the suffering servant, mm-hmm. and how God is going to see his sacrifice and be satisfied. This is the sacrifice that must be offered. And so here is that situation in which God cannot help. God cannot save his son, no matter how much that he wanted to. And Jesus felt that separation in that sense, that here God could not reach forth and save him at this time. And there were those, again, still mocking, thinking maybe he cried out to Elijah, whether these names were similar, or whether at this time Jesus' speech is beginning to be altered or slurred because of the pain and because of the lack of breath, that they misunderstood what he was saying. But basically they've said, leave him alone and let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
In verse 50, Jesus cried again with a loud voice and yielded up the ghost. And so we see that death that is carried out now on the cross for us. And then let's look in verse... Chip, I tell you what, we're going to have to pause in terms of reading. I certainly...
Well, I tell you what, whatever you don't cover today, let's just get into it tomorrow, because
okay.
chapter 28's only got 20 verses,
okay.
so Richard and I can pick up wherever it is you end.
Okay.
That'd be a good thing, dude.
Then we'll look at some of the events here that are in connection with the cross and with his death, beginning again in verse 51. It said, behold, the veil of the temple was written to from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks rent, and the graves were opened, and many of the bodies of the saints which slept arose, came out of the graves after his resurrection, went into the holy city, and appeared unto many. Now when the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, truly, this was the Son of God. And many women were there beholding afar off, which followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering unto him, among which was Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, the mother of Zebedee's children. And when the evening was come, there was a rich man of Arimathea named Joseph, who himself was also a disciple of Jesus. And he went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus, and Pilate commanded the body to be delivered. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, laid it in his own new tomb, from which he had hewn it out of the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulchre, and departed. And there was Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, sitting over against the sepulchre. You know, as we look here, here's Jesus, the time of his death, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, after having suffered for about 6 hours. And we know that he died there. There was not only were they going to crush his knees, but they found that he had already died. His side was going to be pierced with a spear. The fact that blood and water came out, all of these accounted or showed the fact that he was indeed dead. And so he has died on the cross. Along with that, not just the earthquake, the darkness, all these things are happening. But here's even the veil of the temple that is going to be rent and torn from top to bottom. And likely the priests have returned to their service. This would be the time of that evening sacrifice. And so they're there in the temple and seeing these things happen before them and opening up, as it were, from the holy place unto the most holy place. Again, representative of Jesus entering in and taking that sacrifice into the most holy place by which he has obtained a way for us into heaven. And wonderful imagery that is going on through this chapter. But then you have these other events of 51 through 53 and the earthquake and the rocks even breaking at this time and graves opening up from which some of the saints would arise after his resurrection and even go into the city, a testimony to his death and to his resurrection, a testimony to the power of God. And that this was not just random events that were happening, but Jesus was indeed the Son of God. And then that powerful statement, the centurion that was sitting there with him, watching these things, he was watching Jesus, he saw the earthquake, he saw everything that was done, and had to come to the conclusion, truly this was the Son of God. There's no doubt in his mind. And no, I don't believe that he was just saying, surely this was a son of the gods, but that he knew of what had been said, he knew what happened, he saw the testimony of the things happening around them, and was indeed convinced this was Jesus, this was the Son of God. And you had those others that were watching, you have the women that knew where the tomb was, that knew what was happening, knew where he was placed. You have Joseph begging Pilate for the body of Jesus. You have the Jews that are going to make the tomb secure. Everybody knew where this was, and it was secured. And so there's Joseph that lovingly prepares Jesus for burial and places in him in his own tomb that had never been used, and there would lay him to rest. And even it says there in verse 61 that Mary and the other Mary were sitting against the sepulchre. They had seen where this had taken place and would go to their homes, even looking forward, and prepare the spices and things for his burial, planning to come back the very next Sunday. And the chapter ends in verse 62 through 66 with the securing of the tomb, that they would not only know where this was, but they were going to guard it so that nothing could happen to the body of Jesus. And yet, even for all that they would do, they could not hold it. And so we're going to begin to wrap up there. I am going to leave verse 62 through 66 and allow Richard and Chip to discuss that a little bit more tomorrow as far as the sealing and making sure of that tomb. But we've gotten to look here at the horrible events of Matthew chapter 27, the culmination of that false, illegal trial of Jesus. Pilate recognizing he was an innocent man, but delivering him to be crucified, the scourging that he would endure, and finally that death on the cross, and to remember that he was dying for you and I. He was dying an innocent and a just man for us and for our sins. And we see all of those things take place here in Matthew chapter 27. And so a wonderful testimony to the love of God, that he would send his son to die for us. And so, friends, we leave you with that. I hope you'll be back with us tomorrow as we move into chapter 28 and replace that bad news of that Black Friday with the happy news of the wonderful Sunday morning from which he would arise from the tomb. And so thank you for being with us this morning.